This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, April 11, 2007. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado. Bush's Director of Intelligence recommends that the president's surveillance powers be extended. A Texas grand jury indicts two former juvenile detention authorities on sex abuse charges as more young alleged survivors step forward.
Joseph was sexually abused both by staff at TYC and by another inmate.
And as the Pentagon considers extending active troops tours of duty, we'll hear about the continued fighting in Baghdad. Those stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. A double bombing today in the Algerian capital of Algiers has killed at least 23 people and wounded over 150. A suicide bomber blew himself up outside of the Algerian prime minister's office. Another attack took place near a police station on the outskirts of the capital. A group calling itself Al-Qaeda in Islamic North Africa has reportedly claimed responsibility for the blasts. Algeria is to hold parliamentary elections next month. Senior Israeli security officials have expressed disappointment and reservations over a proposal to exchange a captured Israeli soldier for hundreds of Palestinian prisoners held in Israeli jails. Rami Al-Megari reports from Gaza.
Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert met with senior security officials yesterday afternoon to discuss the list of prisoners that Palestinian negotiators want released in exchange for captured Israeli corporal Gilad Shalit. Israeli officials say the list includes some prisoners thought to have killed Israelis, yet they hinted that Israel might consider releasing others on the list. According to Egyptian mediators who delivered the list to Israel, the prisoners' swab has not failed and that they are looking forward to a formal Israeli response to the proposal by next week. Corporal Gilad Shalit was captured in Gaza last June by Palestinian resistance groups in a cross-border raid on an Israeli army base. His capture resulted in a deadly massive Israeli attack on Gaza. For Free Speech Radio News and IMEMC.org, this is Rami Al-Mighari reporting from Gaza.
A U.S. delegation wrapped up a four-day trip to North Korea today. Led by New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, the team traveled to the reclusive state to recover the remains of American servicemen killed during the Korean War. Their mission came just a few days ahead of the deadline for North Korea to shut down its main nuclear facility. From Seoul, FSRN's Jason Strother has more.
Governor Richardson and his team crossed the heavily fortified demilitarized zone into South Korea on Wednesday, bringing with them the remains of six U.S. soldiers killed more than 50 years ago. Though not officially in North Korea to discuss the ongoing nuclear standoff, the team did pressure the Kim Jong-il regime to abide by the agreement made earlier this year to shut down its Yongbyon reactor by April 14th. Speaking at a press conference in Seoul, Richardson announced that Pyongyang will permit international inspectors to return to the site within one day after they receive the $25 million frozen in Macau's Banco Delta Asia. The North's access to these funds was blocked after the Bush administration claimed the account was laundering counterfeit dollars. The bank announced today that the money is now ready for North Korea to withdraw. Richardson warned that it may be difficult for North Korea to fully shut down the reactor by this weekend's deadline and noted that Pyongyang officials said it may take up to 30 more days. For Free Speech Radio News in Seoul, South Korea, I'm Jason Strother.
The interim government of Bangladesh today charged former Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina and dozens of other opposition politicians with murder. Charges stem from the deaths of four rival party supporters during street protests that turned deadly in late October of 2006. Hasina and her 14-party alliance had been agitating for reforms in the lead-up to national elections originally scheduled for January 22nd. Those elections have since been postponed, and Bangladesh's military-backed interim government has kept the country under a state of emergency for months. The country's Electoral Commission has said it may take as long as 18 months to compile an accurate voter roll, which means elections could be as far as 2 years away. More than 200 Mexican media workers and their supporters marched in the resort city of Acapulco yesterday to demand justice for a television reporter murdered there last week. Vladimir Flores reports.
Journalists who participated in yesterday's march later wrote that plainclothes police constantly followed their demonstration with video cameras, the journalists want guarantees to exercise their rights of free expression as well as a serious investigation into the assassination of Amado Ramírez. The Televisa reporter was shot 6 times last week shortly after leaving his program on a local radio station. Hours after the march, federal police arrested 2 men that supposedly confessed to the murder. Statements issued by the Federal Preventative Police indicate that Genaro Vázquez Durán and Leonel Bustos Muñoz were detained at a checkpoint due to their suspicious attitude and for possession of firearms. Police say that 2 men confessed to the crime after claiming an armed group was trying to kill them. In recent years, the number of media workers killed in Mexico has surpassed that of Colombia. Most of these crimes are left unresolved. For FSRN, I am Vladimir Flores.
And I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News. The president's director of national intelligence, Mike McConnell, is recommending that the president's surveillance powers be extended. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more on that story and speaks with a recipient of a national security letter, the only one who's now free to talk about the situation.
Just 3 months into the job, National Intelligence Director Mike McConnell released a 100-day plan to improve intelligence gathering and sharing. Among those improvements are ways it could expand the government's surveillance powers. The proposal would allow the use of hidden cameras, the searching of luggage, and the entering of homes to search computers. Lisa Graves is with the Center for National Security Studies. She thinks this could be an effort to remove jurisdiction from the independent court system currently in charge of surveillance and instead giving it to the intelligence agencies, possibly jeopardizing protections, she says.
It seems that there's an effort to basically rewrite the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. This act, as your listeners know, is the act that the president already violated hundreds, if not thousands of times through the warrantless wiretapping program. It's the same act that the Patriot Act changed to make it easier to get a warrant, and then the administration bypassed those very rules. So now the administration appears determined yet again to change to formally change the rules for foreign intelligence surveillance on these shores.
A spokesperson for the Director of National Intelligence said the purpose is not to expand powers, but to modernize intelligence for the 21st century. The proposal would protect telecommunication companies from lawsuits so they can freely hand over information to the administration. It would also allow the intelligence agencies to monitor non-citizens without a warrant.
We have no privacy if this goes through.
Christopher Pyle is a professor of politics at Holyoke University. He's been studying civil liberties protections since Watergate.
This is the most serious assault on our Constitution in our history. We've never had an administration this aggressive or a Congress this supine.
I am totally in support of the director. I think he wants to protect our country. He knows what it takes to do it.
Senator Orrin Hatch, Republican of Utah, says he would not object to plans to expand the surveillance. But if the administration expands the program legally, they'll have to go through Congress. Again, Senator Hatch.
I question whether the so-called civil libertarians will allow that work to be done.
Congress attempted to alter the rules of the surveillance program last year, but talks failed. This request by the administration comes when they're being closely watched for misuse of civil liberties, including the abuse of surveillance of American citizens. In addition, last month, an inspector general found the administration abused the use of national security letters. At least 143,000 of these letters were sent to inform people that their financial or communications records were being sought. George Christian is a librarian who received one of these letters. He's the only person who has been released from the mandatory gag order issued alongside the letters.
After 5 months, there was no way to know who was in the library on that day. We interpreted the national security letter as requesting the identities of the patrons, all the patrons at that library, and we were appalled by such a sweeping request.
And have you received any response and or any answers since then?
No, we have not. We have no idea what the FBI was looking for. We were gagged. We were maintained gagged, even though we went to three separate courts, a district court, an appellate court, and the Supreme Court, until after the Patriot Act was renewed, and then suddenly the FBI decided that it was no longer necessary to gag us. And about 6 months after that, they decided that they really didn't want the information that was sought by the National Security Letter.
Director McConnell is expected to lay out his proposal before the Intelligence Committee's next Tuesday. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Defense officials are deciding whether to extend the tours of duty for as many as 15,000 active U.S. troops by 3 months, meaning they would serve 15 rather than 12 months. Although a decision has yet to be made, Secretary of Defense Robert Gates may make the announcement in the coming days. As the Iraq security plan continues, violence increases generally throughout the country and specifically in Baghdad. Tuesday saw fierce fighting in central Baghdad, with some residents saying as many as 40 people were killed in day-long clashes between local Sunni fighters and the U.S. military. Hiba Dawood reports.
Al-Fadl is in the center of Baghdad. There, Iraqi forces backed by American vehicles and helicopters raided the mostly Sunni neighborhood and shot to death two young men thought to be involved in attacks against the government and occupation forces. Odail Jabouri is a 30-year-old resident and owner of an auto repair shop in Fadl. He describes the event.
In the beginning, the Iraqi and American forces came into the neighborhood at night and took two young men out of their house. They were brothers, 17 and 18 years old, and executed them in front of everyone. The spark was lit.
In Iraq's current climate of daily violence, Oday says there is a statement that anyone could face death anyway. Why not do so while resisting?
No one is scared of the government fighting people. We consider ourselves as dead already. Of course, when they killed those young people, some people of 20 or even 40 could get killed too. This is it. It is a show that is repeated every day. This is not a solution. The military solution is not really a solution.
Inside the Iraqi parliament, some parties disapprove the security plan. Saleh Mutlaq is a member of the parliament with the Accord Front list, a group of Sunni parties. He says that the security plan will fail if the government used force and violence to implement it.
I assure you that the solution is that the American and the Iraqi governments should have a political project, not a force and violence project, and the security plan built only on the use of force won't succeed unless the government rethinks the political process as a whole.
Mutlaq also describes the current government as unjust.
If you think anyone can win over the people's will, you are wrong. Injustice doesn't last. The government is oppressing people, and they have the weapons. If they didn't have them, they would never have been able to win. And this is not victory. The victory is when they become fair. But if they keep using force in the same way, they will only add more truculence to people to resist the occupation, those who oppress them.
Meanwhile, Iraqi police announced that they found 9 dead bodies in Baghdad today. The bodies were shot to death. I'm Hiba Dawood for FSRN.
Nearly 2 million additional voters have registered ahead of France's presidential election, with the first round due in less than 2 weeks' time. It's the highest rise since 1981, when a dramatic lurch to the left made François Mitterrand France's first and only socialist president. This year's campaign includes 12 candidates, with three leading the polls: Nicolas Sarkozy for the right-wing UMP, Ségolène Royal for the Socialists, and center-right candidate François Bayrou. FSRN's Tony Cross visited the Paris suburb of Argenteuil to find out what's boosted the interest in this year's poll.
Hey, t'entends pas ou quoi? C'est Jackie Brown qui vous parle. L'avenir est entre nos mains.
French rapper Jackie Brown tells his fans to register the vote in no uncertain terms.
Ouvre-la. Boom!
He joined a dozen recording stars at the end of last year in a video to encourage young people to cast their ballots. Campaigners even organized a march from Paris to Strasbourg, chosen because it held the record for cars burnt during the riots which hit France's housing projects in 2005. That eruption of violence came to symbolize the bitterness of youths, many of them of immigrant origin, who lived in neglected areas and faced unemployment or low-paid short-term jobs. The campaigners told them that voting could make their voices heard without smashing up the neighborhood. The Paris suburb of Argenteuil got a lot of coverage during the riots, thanks to then-Interior Minister Nicolas Sarkozy. On a visit to a housing estate there, he told residents that he would sort out the scum responsible for crime. The remark was taken as typifying Sarkozy's opinion of all underprivileged youth. Along with his tear gas-led policies at the ministry, it helped make him a hate figure for some and popular with others. Sarkozy is now presidential candidate for the UMP, which controls Argenteuil Town Council. At the plush modern town hall, spokesperson Richard Giobiano regrets what the publicity has done to the town's image.
Argenteuil is just like any other town, with its difficulties and its strengths. There is one little difference. We have about the youngest population in the area, and the area is one of the most youthful in France. We are a town with businesses, people who work. It's true that the unemployment rate is a little higher than average. We have social problems, housing problems like everywhere else, and particularly everywhere in the Paris region.
In this average town, the voter lists have grown by just under the national average of 4.2%, although neighboring Seine-Saint-Denis and Paris have doubled that figure. Giobiano believes that some young voters have registered to show their opposition to violent protests. On the street, no one seems very positively inspired by any of the candidates. Some young whites seem attracted by promises to reduce immigration by Sarkozy and Jean-Marie Le Pen of the far-right National Front. Voters of immigrant origin do seem negatively inspired by those candidates. Michel, an airport worker, says that everyone he knows wants to prevent Le Pen getting through to the second round, as he did in 2001.
Oh yes, I think that's a national phenomenon. We saw what happened last time. Everyone I know is going to vote, including my son, who was 18 years old recently.
Sarkozy inspires a violent, if not obscene, reaction among some young residents. While Le Pen came to the town last Friday, Sarkozy called off a planned visit. Mohamed believes he was frightened to come.
If he'd come, it would have finished badly for him. He's being tactical. Either he'll pay a surprise visit at the last minute or he won't do it at all. He's frightened. And if that's how he's going to lead France, God help France.
Nadia is a young mother who has put her name on the voter list for the first time to stop Le Pen and Sarkozy. For the sake of her children, she hopes that there'll be less racism in the future. And she hopes that the left will help working-class people.
We need more housing, and wages are really low for all French people, I think. The minimum wage is really low, 1,000 euros a month. There are families living on that. It's very little.
A high turnout in this year's election looks likely. Whether it will have more effect on the politicians than the riots remains to be seen. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Argenteuil.
The multi-billion-dollar piece of legislation known as the Farm Bill comes before Congress for reauthorization every 5 years. The complex legislation is a stew of competing interests. Small farmers, large agribusiness, and the nation's hungry and their advocates will all vie for a share of the $300 billion in subsidies. Funding for food stamps and other supplemental nutrition programs remains critically low. $30 billion has been cut in food stamps since welfare reform in 1996, and while $6.4 billion was restored in 2002, that amount is still not enough for the nation's 35 million people who experience food insecurity. If the programs remain underfunded, the nation's hungry will be forced to turn to food banks for support. Martha Baskin has more.
What we have seen over the last 5 or so years is an increase in the number of working folks, working families coming to the food banks.
Shelley Rotondo, executive director of Northwest Harvest, Washington State's largest private food bank, says the cost of living is outstripping people's income, forcing them to make trade-offs between food and medicine, food and daycare, and food and housing.
There is no such thing as a daycare bank or a housing bank, but there are food banks. And so we offer food so people can transition from what often is a crisis back to stability.
Statewide, this food bank sees 500,000 visits a month. Mirroring the national situation, 40% of the visitors are families with children.
So you want that dry milk, dry instant milk?
Fresh produce, staples such as rice and potatoes, ham and bacon, and bag lunches are available for today's diverse crowd. A couple from New Orleans, homeless men with large backpacks, mothers with children, and middle-aged immigrants who bring their own shopping bags stand in line.
Oh, deal for us because we're here from New Orleans, so it's really helping us, you know, right now until we get on our feet.
The couple say they're getting a place tomorrow. Most are reluctant to talk, but a woman who says she's on her lunch break shares a few words.
I come for lunch so often. Going through low-income housing, my mental health right now just helps me on lunchtime.
Food banks are critical, says Linda Stone, an advocate for federal hunger programs, but they have nowhere near the impact of the federal food stamp program.
The program is our number one defense against hunger. It's been around for 30 years now, and it is our major tool to try to stem the tide of hunger among kids and families.
The problem, says Stone, is that people run out of food stamps about 2.5 weeks into the month. The average person on food stamps gets $1 a meal, an amount that's based on a very old formula of what it takes for a family to eat. Linda Najat is president of Washington State's Food Lifeline, a member of the nation's largest hunger relief organization, America's Second Harvest, which provided emergency food assistance to 25 million needy people last year.
Hunger advocates are really seeking help from lawmakers right now.
Unfortunately, federal food programs face the near constant threat of government cuts. An alarming deficit and spending for the war in Iraq mean that not everyone who is eligible for federal food assistance receives it. Since welfare reform in 1996, says Najat, $30 billion has been cut from the food stamp program.
So one of the first things that we are asking for as advocates is that adequate funding needs to be put on the table for the Farm Bill.
Najat says the second challenge hunger advocates are working on is increased access to food stamps and supplemental nutrition programs. Only 33% of the people standing in line at food banks are enrolled in the food stamp program. Most are excluded because they make slightly more than the program allows. According to the Economic Policy Institute, the cost of living for a family of two was $3,300 a month in 2006, yet the designated poverty level was $1,200 a month. Anyone who earned above was denied supplemental food support.
What we find in the U.S. is sort of a perfect storm.
Eric Holt Jimenez with Food First in Oakland, California. Holt Jimenez says the Farm Bill is dominated by the agri-food industry.
In what's really a dysfunctional food system that ends up producing, 36 to 38 million hungry people in the richest country on earth.
Companies such as Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland receive billions in the form of subsidies to grow rice, wheat, and corn. These companies then turn the crops into processed food with little or no nutritional value, what Holt Jimenez calls messes, or manufactured edible substitute substances. Food First and other hunger advocates propose an increase in food stamp benefit allotments to increase people's ability to buy healthy foods. They also support expanding the size and scope of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Community Food Projects Competitive Grants Program to establish programs that supply healthy local foods to underserved markets. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Martha Baskin reporting.
A Texas grand jury handed down felony sexual abuse charges against two former administrators at a juvenile detention center. The charges that they use their power to prey on teenage boys are at the center of a statewide scandal that could result in a flood of litigation as alleged victims come forward from other facilities. FSRN's Renee Feltz reports.
It's been 2 months since allegations against a former principal and an assistant superintendent shook the Texas Youth Commission. On Tuesday, a grand jury officially charged the men with engaging in illegal sexual activity with male youth offenders aged 16 to 19. They allegedly summoned the inmates to their office to fondle them or have oral sex. The men both claim innocence and are in jail now as they await a hearing. Their indictments could begin a flood of litigation as youth offenders at other state facilities continue to come forward with other claims of sexual abuse, including Joseph Galloway, who was released last week after serving 4 years for a 9-month sentence. On Tuesday, Galloway's attorney, Scott Medlock, filed the first lawsuit since allegations surfaced against the Youth Commission.
Joseph was sexually abused both by staff at TYC and by another inmate. A female guard at the Giddings unit performed oral sex on Joseph, and Joseph was placed in a cell also at the Giddings unit by another officer, even though the other inmate in that cell was yelling things like, "I want a piece of that ass, and I'm going to rape him."
Joseph Galloway says the class action suit seeks no financial damages.
I'm not in this for the money. I don't care if I get $2 out of this lawsuit.
Instead, the suit asked the court to enact immediate policy changes at TYC.
Some of the other changes might take longer to hammer out, but there need to be things done now to make sure that these children are safe. Releasing a lot of them last week, those who had completed the rehabilitation program and didn't deserve to be there any longer in the first place, is a good step. But they need to seriously look at all the extremely serious problems in these facilities and make sure that these children are safe as a first priority.
Galloway's sexual assault claims are under investigation and could lead to another indictment. In Houston, I'm Renee Feltz for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Monica Lopez and Taina Gysi produce our newscast. Our headlines editor is Shannon Young. DC editor is Leanne Caldwell. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley includes Eric Klein and Antonio Ortiz. We podcast online at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn.org. From KPFK in Los Angeles, this is Aura Bogado.